Hello and welcome to Swiss Info's programme for February the 1st. I'm Julia Slater in Bern. This week we focus on innovative science, future and past.
I'm very pleased. I congratulate the institutes involved in their research. This is proof that Swiss science enjoys great respect and is heading in the right direction.
That was Johann Schneider-Ammann, Minister of Education and Research, not surprisingly upbeat about the news that the Human Brain Project, coordinated by Lausanne's Federal Institute of Technology, or EPFL, has been selected for one of the European Union's flagship grants, worth more than €1 billion. That's 1.25 billion Swiss francs over the next 10 years. It's quite an achievement. The HBP, as it's known, was one of two winners selected from a short list of four finalists for the huge award, whose aim is to reward European scientific breakthroughs and assert Europe's position as a knowledge superpower. The HBP project will use supercomputers to create the most detailed model of the human brain to date. It will then simulate drugs and treatments for neurological diseases and related ailments. EPFL President Patrick Ebischer was also cock-a-hoop.
As you know, we've been working on this project for a number of years. For me, it's an extraordinary culmination of the vision we had, that these worlds, the worlds of information technology, of physics, of mathematics, of neuroscience, are growing closer together. And we can say this project is a kind of illustration of this vision.
It should be said, however, that it's by no means a purely Swiss project. It brings together more than 80 research institutions, not only in Europe, but also in the USA and Japan. The HBP wasn't the only Swiss-led project that was in line for the money. The Nanoelectronic Devices Laboratory, also of the EPFL, had submitted a project called Guardian Angels for a Smarter Life. I spoke to laboratory head Professor Adrian Ionescu, asking how he felt about the failure of his project to get the grant.
Of course, I am taking it on the positive side. You know, just being in the forest was just extraordinary. And for us, what is very, very important is that we created a community in a domain that, in my opinion, is of crucial importance for the economic growth in Europe. This field is the field of smart system and energy-efficient technology. This is really where we should go in the future in Europe.
Brave words. And he's encouraged by the determination of the partner institutions to continue the work, although they must now look for funds elsewhere. But he pointed to a real problem in the European flagship approach.
I think that at some moment we should stop to prepare marathon-long type of proposal. We are writing this proposal and preparing it for more than 2 years. I think it's time now to transform this in work, because people in other places of the world, they are working. And of course, we do not want again to say, well, now we'll see how we make other proposal and see what's happening in 1 year. And so we cannot do that, because all the momentum is lost. And, you know, in this domain where we are, everything will be outdated very, very quickly. So we should to act immediately, and we hope that politicians will understand that this is very important.
The biochemist Gottfried Schatz, speaking on German language television, was critical about the award of the grant to a huge project for which the fundamentals are not yet known.
Innovations often come from people thinking outside the box, who are working on something quite different, working independently, against the current. The more organized a project is, the more independent thinkers, and above all young people, unfortunately, will be pushed into the background.
That made me wonder how grants for scientific research are usually allocated in Switzerland. So I spoke to Ori Schipper of the Swiss National Science Foundation, a major source of science funding.
We still think research should operate as freely as possible and with the least constraints. And the biggest degree of freedom you have when you have the small bottom-up projects. 90% of our money goes into that kind of project.
As for Ionescu's point that writing proposals eats up time that could be spent on doing research, that's probably inevitable.
If you take an overall look, not every project is accepted. There are a lot of proposals written which do not get funded as well. So I don't think this flagship initiative significantly increased the workload of the research community.
Stefan Kudelski, whose death has just been announced, was a great engineering pioneer who certainly thought outside the box. And he made his breakthrough when he was still a student in the early 1950s.
Today we feature the third installment in our Sunday series, Reporter's Notebook. This is Bob Zanotti, and I'm speaking from a cable car taking the Reporter's Notebook team up to the famous restaurant atop the Schildhorn, better known perhaps to James Bond fans as Piz Gloria, located in the Bernese Alps.
Ah, the good old days of radio. That's a recording made for our English language shortwave service back in 1974. And it was made using Kudelski's groundbreaking invention, the portable tape recorder, the Nagra. I spoke to two colleagues here at Swiss Info about their memories of this mythical machine. I began with Franco Janni, one of our technicians, who started 25 years ago when we were still Swiss Radio International. I asked him if he had fond memories of the device.
Yes, of course. Like every sound technician, it's something mythical for me. And when I started here 25 years ago, my first job was to go for 1 week to Kudelski in Chezo to learn how to repair, how to fix every problem with Nagra.
What was it like going on this course?
When I started to work here at Swiss Radio International, collaborate also with some NGO. And we have two guests from Guinea, two technicians, and they came with two Nagra, very old, destroyed. And we went together there to fix the first one and understand how to make it. And after, they stay 2 weeks with me here in Bern to fix the second one. And after 2-3 weeks, they go back with two Nagra in perfect condition. And I think that maybe still now they are working.
So the Nagra was really a very, very good machine.
Yeah, I think it's the best they never had in all the planet for this kind of jobs like journalism or movies and everything else. It's perfect.
What was so good about it?
Yeah, it's very strong. You can it supports temperature high, low, and even water. I heard the story, but they says that somebody put it in the water, and they keep it out quickly, take out the batteries, dry it on the sun, and the day after it was still working. If it's true or not, I never try, but I can imagine that it's possible.
And you couldn't do that today with the kind of instruments that we have now.
No, forget it.
But the problem with the Nagra was that it was very heavy, though, wasn't it?
Ah, this is the problem. Most of the journalists complain about the heavy things. If you take an example, Nagra A, I think it's about 5 kilos, and you have also 12 batteries inside, so you can imagine.
How have recorders developed since the Nagra was replaced?
Yeah, everything was with tapes, of course. And now with the new technology, you have all the materials with memory cards and this kind of things. Of course, it's much more practical and you have much more capacity of recording. With the Nagra, it was only 20 minutes for each tape. Every 20 minutes, you have to change. Now you can record for 3 hours without to stop. This is another advantage. But for the quality of the material, there's nothing to compare. Also for the price. The Nagra was very, very expensive. It was, I think, if I remember, between 5,000 and 8,000 francs.
I know that some of my colleagues were so fond of their Nagras that they kept them after they'd been withdrawn from circulation here at Swiss Radio International, Swiss Info, of course, as we are now. Can you understand that?
Yes, I can understand very well because I'm one of the lucky guys. We can buy one of them, and of course, it's a little bit of nostalgia, but I keep it. It's a good remembering of this time of the sounds.
Do you use it?
I don't use it, but it's still working.
I then turn to Scott Kapper, a colleague from the English department, who began his journalistic career at Radio Fribourg in the early 1990s.
The Nagra was, for a young journalist, was a very heavy piece of equipment that made your shoulders hurt after a couple of hours, and you could recognise most of us walking around sideways. On the other hand, they were very, very good recording devices. The sound was fantastic. The downside, like I said, was the weight, and of course the batteries had a limited life. And something that most people won't know about was also you were recording on tape.
And what was the implication of that then?
Well, with tape, you had a limited supply of time to do an interview. The other aspect of that, of course, was when you're getting back, then you had to edit on the tape as well.
Was that particularly difficult?
It's not difficult per se, but it's somewhat a lengthy process depending on how your interview partner talked. If they had a lot of hesitations or a lot of breaks in the way they were talking, you were spending a lot of time sitting down trying to find the exact spot where they'd fluffed along the way and cutting that out. The Niagara, to a large extent, was a Rolls-Royce solution. Very good, very efficient, but also maybe too much power for what it had to do. If you're doing a quick interview for a news program, the important is that people understand what is being said, but they don't worry so much about the quality of the sound.
You said that you only had, 15 minutes of tape, so you really had to concentrate and think about what you were asking. That's probably quite an advantage, isn't it?
It depends. I mean, you could be very clear on what you wanted for an answer, but I'm not sure that the person across the other side of the microphone would know that. You let them talk, and depending on your level of experience, it's hard to interrupt somebody who's talking, particularly if you feel that you owe them a certain amount of respect. So it could be a little bit difficult, and if you had three questions, you're at the end of your tape, and you still had 10 other questions to ask, it wasn't any better.
So sometimes you were finding yourself interrupting the flow because you suddenly had to say, stop, 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 I've got to change the tape.
Exactly. I mean, and it always happens that when they're saying something really interesting, the tape runs out. And when you ask them the second time, the answer is never as interesting as you hope for.
Scott Kappa. And I must admit that the lightweight electronic recording devices we use today do indeed have lots of advantages. But that's not to disparage Kudelski's achievement. I asked Stefano Cavalieri of the Swiss National Sound Archives Foundation in Lugano what it was that Kudelski did that was so innovative, given that sound recording technology was already available.
Niagara came out with an idea, a brilliant idea, I would say, that was trying to put the same technology, to squeeze it a little bit, and to place it into something portable.
And why had nobody been able to do this before?
I don't know, probably because nobody else had the idea. it's not a matter of having the possibility to do it or not. The technology was there, but Mr. Kudelski had this brilliant thought to try to do it and to take advantage of the Swiss manufacturing quality.
We've already heard how it became an indispensable tool for broadcasters, but they weren't the only ones who benefited.
It was used for broadcasting and for scientific research, you know, for research on languages, for example, ethnographical research, because it was finally possible to get the scientists to some very remote spots in the world and start documenting from a sound recording perspective life scenes and just everything they found.
Stefan Kudelski called his machine the Nagra because it means it records in his native Polish. He fled Warsaw with his family in 1939 at the beginning of the Second World War when he was 10. They arrived in Switzerland in 1943. In a tribute to him on the company's website, its vice chairman described him as one of those personalities who contributed to the international reputation of Switzerland. And that wraps up the programme for today. Don't forget you can always find news and information about Switzerland on our website, swissinfo.ch. Thanks for listening and tune in again next week. I'm Julia Slater in Bern.